Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Welcome to another edition of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. And in this episode, I sit down with actor Andrew Garfield. When you look at Andrew Garfield's career, you have to wonder how one actor can be so consistently successful in choosing projects and roles. His work in Never Let Me Go, The Social Network, Boy A, 99 Homes, and Hacksaw Ridge are widely acknowledged as some of the most vulnerable and compelling on screen. You also have to wonder how he stands it. He calls his art torture and agony, a constant roller coaster ride for the ego. So why do it? Because it's unthinkable to do anything else. His path to acting wasn't easy. He butted heads with his dad, who wanted him to do something safe. Then he butted up against his own crippling self-doubt, almost fleeing his very first stage performance. That's when a chance encounter convinced him that while stepping on a stage might kill him, not stepping on the stage definitely would. He's gone on to work with some of the best directors around, experiences he talks about in our conversation. And despite his success, he says that he lives in perpetual dissatisfaction, and likely always will. I think that's what makes him the artist that he is. Andrew's a guy who knows there's always more to find in himself and his work, and that's what keeps us watching. His journey as an artist inspired and touched me, as does his belief that his craft goes deeper than mere entertainment. As an army medic in Mel Gibson's Hacksaw Ridge, Andrew takes great risks to heal wounds. As you'll hear, he's into that kind of thing. So pull up a chair and listen in. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, Sam.
Thanks for doing this.
Thanks for doing this.
I met you once before, as we were just talking about, and I met you on a film, on a discussion for a film that didn't end up going.
Yeah.
And it's sort of an interesting thing, because when you think about all the films that get set up to some extent, or there's a good script, and for some reason or another, the project doesn't go.
Yeah.
I mean, that is 100 times more common than the ones that do go. Mm. But it makes me wonder, do you have to develop some sort of a process for, or criteria for how to get into a project that, beyond like loving the script? Or
I don't have a code. I think it's always changing.
Yeah?
Yeah, I feel really lucky that I've landed where I've landed with everything that I've done up to this moment. And yet there's always, I mean, this is the crazy thing, and there's always this perpetual dissatisfaction, which is odd. Even with being so specific and precise about whether or not my heart wants to dive into something that I'm presented with, there's always this strange dissatisfaction, which I find really kind of
In what way?
Interesting.
What do you
mean? I don't know. I think about, doesn't Neil Young have a recurring dream of like the perfect melody?
Yeah, right.
That he wakes up and forgets every morning.
Exactly.
It's like that. And as an actor, as you understand, that your autonomy is limited to what you say yes and no to in the first place.
Right.
But in terms of choosing, it's become maybe the most important moment of the process for me, because of that lack of and I think what I'm realizing, which is or what I'm understanding in a deeper way, is that this is a filmmaker, this is the director's medium, this is absolute. Unless it's a studio film, in which case it's a studio's medium. Whoever has final cut, whoever gets to decide what story is being told and what story is being given to an audience of potentially millions of people, that the power in that is so there's so much possibility, as we know, with films and how it can change people and affect people, and the ripples that stories seen in that mass way can send out through a culture. So if I'm going to go to work on something, I have to look to see who's going to be shaping the story for an audience, and that's really the main criteria for me, is like, are you Am I going to give, do I feel comfortable enough giving myself to you? Because that's what you have to do as an actor. I'm discovering.
Right. You know? Have you changed your approach to how to speak to a director about a project now that you know more about that process?
That's interesting. I think when I first started, it was kind of this kind of gift and wound thing, and the gift of just starting out was that rawness and that kind of almost, I felt like an animal on set. Like I was like sniffing everything, and kind of, it was all just very instinctive, and there was no censorship, there was no consciousness really. It was all just like kind of terrifying. I felt very close to the essence of what I was trying to bring.
Right.
And then as you go on, I find myself getting a little more versed in how a thing works, and maybe a little more confident, which can be a little bit of a dangerous thing. So at first I was very needy of a director. And I think I put too much pressure on a director to give me to be that kind of guiding father or mother figure.
Right.
And then I think I didn't want to do that anymore. So I become more self-reliant. And also you realize that, you know, that's not their job to babysit. It's not their job to help hold your hand.
Or to help your confidence.
Totally, yeah. And sometimes you do need that. You know, sometimes I think if you're not feeling vulnerable on set as an actor, then there's something maybe maybe you're not going as deep as you can. That's for me anyway. If I don't feel a little frightened and a little terrified of what I may or may not do, or where I may or may not get to in a scene, then and if I don't need a little bit of reassurance, then I'm probably not doing it right, because you want to be a little bit on the, well, you know, you want to be on the edge of you want to be on the edge of what you're doing. I want to surprise myself. I don't want to know how it's going to go. I don't want to know what I'm going to say. I don't want, you know.
Right. And in the beginning, you just hope the fear doesn't shut you down,
kill
right?
You.
But then when you get confident, then you hope the fear doesn't disappear. It's like modulating the fear.
That's
right?
It. It's right. Yeah. It's like it's staying in the tension. It's staying in the heat of failing. There's something beautiful about failing, which we don't often get opportunities to do, especially on a film set where there's not much time. That was one thing about working with Fincher on Social Network. We had so many takes, we had so much, all of the budget went to time. So the actors were basically told, just fucking fuck up, fuck up, fuck up, fuck up, fuck up, fuck up, fuck up.
Really?
Because out of those fuck ups comes truth and spontaneity and freedom to see where something goes, as opposed to trying to fit it in, you know, on a tighter schedule shoot.
When I hear you talking about that, I think, okay, you have all the time in the world,
mm-hmm.
but how does that sort of jibe with looking for not knowing what you're going to say and not knowing what's going to happen?
Yeah, I mean, with Fincher, there was a period between take 15 and 25, 26, where everything just becomes totally, like, you feel like a robot. And the words become meaningless, and it's like repeating a word over and over again. But after that, you slip into some other transcendental place, and everything takes on a deeper meaning, and you slip into somewhere deeper that he's waiting for. But, I don't know, more and more for me, treating the film set or rehearsal room and stage like a playground feels like the way to get to the kind of work that I want to be doing. But there is something so awesome about freedom to really, you know, James Dean, whenever he would get self-conscious on set or feel like he wasn't getting it right, he would go and just piss in the corner.
Actually piss in
the
corner.
Yeah, apparently.
Really, like a dog marking his territory.
Like a dog marking like opening himself up and going, here's the most vulnerable part of me. I'm going to do it in front of everybody, and because I'm not willing for this to be mediocre. I'm not willing for this to be guarded in any way. I want to be totally exposed, and I can feel myself trying to get it right now. I'm getting tight, and I'm getting self-conscious, and I want to please you. I want to fuck that. I'm just going to piss right here, and then let's see what happens. Hi.
Those are the good old days in the movie business. Where you can just piss on set. Now they make you go to the bathroom.
Well, sometimes Fincher doesn't let you go to the bathroom, so you have to piss on set.
Do you like that though? Do you like a director that is going to have the confidence to work you so hard.
I love it. If it's someone that I love, if it's someone whose taste I jibe with and who I respect and trust. So yeah, Fincher I just adore. And same with Mel and Marty and a lot of the wonderful direct, like John Crowley, and I've worked with incredible gifted masters really.
Well, I would think that one of the things about being a director is you get to set the tone on your set, and you create your environment. And as an actor, you sort of have to come in and adapt to every different director's environment, right?
Or not.
But I would think Fincher would probably be a different environment than Scorsese.
Totally.
Different than Crowley or whoever. Yeah. Like, what was different and unique about a Scorsese set that you hadn't dealt with before?
That's a good question. It's not part of my prep. It's just something that you kind of assimilate to. I find myself just paying close attention to who I'm with, and if it fits with where I want to be and how I want to work.
Yeah.
Difference with Scorsese set. It's very quiet.
He likes it quiet.
It's beautifully quiet, which I love, and it's full of tension, which I love.
Really?
Tension in a very positive way.
What do you love about tension?
There's energy in it. It's like a tense silence, which is beautiful. Not tension between people. It's just the quiet creates such a reverence for what may appear.
Right.
It's like everyone surrounding the time between action and cut. Whereas someone like Mel is just very loose, and you can't really feel the difference between action and cut, and he's just kind of like having a ball with everybody, and it's a bit of a gathering, and everyone's an equal, and there's no hierarchy, and it's just all a kind of fuck about. But then he's very serious about the work, and then when he's excited about the work, he's just like he's kinetic, so he feeds off that kind of energy and that kind of kineticism. Which I had to adjust to after being with Marty, who
I would think
it was.
Yeah.
I think more naturally I like this quiet, but there was something awesome about finding my way with the kinetic life force that Mel is, and the energy that he creates, and the casualness and the ease, and he's just relaxed, keep it like it was nice, because that's a big part of being on a film set. Talk about this. Play space when you want to enter that play space.
Yeah.
If you're here, it's like the James Dean thing. If you're here, you're not gonna. It's hard to move,
Right.
But if you're coming from that still lake place within yourself, then there's so much potential.
Well, you know what I'm thinking of when you're saying that is the scene in The Social Network where you find out the company's been taken away from you.
Mm-hmm.
That's obviously the big pivotal scene of the whole film.
And,
and it's a big, long scene. It's not it's not something short that you're going to shoot in half a day.
No.
That's an all-day thing, I'm assuming, or more.
Yeah.
Can you take me back to sort of the lead-up to that scene and how you had to deal with it?
Sure, yeah. It's nice to think about it because it was a very special shoot.
Yeah.
And yeah, that day, of course, it looms large. It's the monster that you're trying to not look at out of the corner of your eye, that's just following you until the night before. And staying free within that pressure is the tricky thing. And I was under the impression that Fincher wouldn't need to do so many takes because he would want that raw emotion in the first few, and
right.
then he'd probably move on. But he didn't. It was the same as ever. I think we did about 35 takes of my coverage of that, and it was absurd. It was totally absurd.
I can imagine.
But staying in it, I just tried to stay in it. But I would get confused about what was he needing that he wasn't getting, and why, and why do we keep doing it? But even with that voice, I was totally trusting of him because it's him, and I just love his films, and I just want. It's the great thing about being on set with a director like that is you want to just give everything to them. And it was a really cool moment at the end because at a certain point I was like, this is never going to end. So I'm just going to stay in it and I'm going to imagine this is never going to fucking end. And I'm just going to be doing this for the next 3 days. So fuck it, I'm in it. And so in between takes, it was just head down, not talking to anybody, and just kind of like keep staying in that internal space. So when he finally said, okay, moving on. It was like, I think I fell to my knees in a very dramatic way. And like people clapped. It was very, very sweet. Because it was just like, I think it was more just like someone had run a marathon.
Yeah.
And everyone was like, oh, you ran a marathon. That was like it wasn't like you did good work. It was more just like that. It was grueling going through that. But he was so, it was a really lovely moment. It was actually one of the first moments on a film set where I really didn't give a fuck how I was doing.
Oh, really? You were able to get out of your own head.
Yeah, whether I was getting it right or not. It was like a caution to the wind, kind of like, next take I might fucking kick the table over. I didn't fucking know, whatever. Whatever happens, have it, fuck it.
Isn't that a funny exercise to see if you take something far enough to where...
Yeah, where it doesn't fucking matter anymore.
Yeah.
You're just diving into the dark. The framework is there within the dialogue, but then you just let every take... The idea, for me anyway, is to let it, sometimes it's dry, sometimes it's numb, sometimes it's full of fire and passion, sometimes it's vulnerable and totally heartbroken and hurt. You know, that's the idea, is you let it, and if you get 35 takes, you're gonna touch everything.
Right.
And then the director goes, I really like that, I like that, that's what I imagined. And then you go home and it feels like you've left it all on the field, as it were. That's the best feeling, is when you feel like, that's the worst feeling sometimes, coming home after a day where it's like you're close up at the end of the day and the light's going down and you get two takes and you go, oh God, motherfuckers. Like the scene is still in me. It's like someone taking the canvas away from a painter after 2 hours. There was
right.
more truth to find. There could have been a moment where, you know, it makes the audience catch their breath, or it kind of, like, there's more to find. There's always more. That's the problem. That's the perpetual dissatisfaction, right? Is that there's always more. That's the Neil Young waking up with
right.
his recurring melody that he can never remember, the perfect song. You know, there's all. That's the beauty of the arts, of the creative.
Yeah, it makes me wonder who you are in your head at that point, if you've become that guy enough to where that's second nature. I mean, I do wonder about what you draw on when you have to relate an emotional situation 30 takes in.
It's always you, isn't it? It's always you. If you're coming from that inside-out approach, it's always you, something in you. Good news is that we're all the same. Good news is that there's not... it's all available to us at all times, you know, and that's the awesome thing about being an actor, or one of the awesome things.
What do you mean it's all available to you?
Like, I could kill someone. You know, I could, you know, I could tear this place apart. I could make love to you right now. I could, you know, it's all possible.
I thought we'd done a lot on the show, but I realized that we've only scratched the surface.
We could try it. I mean,
could you make love to Nate first?
Oh God, if you insist. But you know what I mean, though. Like, it's all possible, and that's where it gets dangerous, right? And that's where it gets exciting. And like, that was uncomfortable to suggest that.
I see what you're saying.
But it's all there.
That's right.
It's all possible all the time. And that's the magic of action and cut, because it makes you go, oh, anything, fuck, now I actually, all that shit I was told as a child, don't be this, don't be that, don't be this, don't mean that, like, fucking fit into the family system, fit into the school system, fit in to the society, and, you know, salute the flag and all this shit. Between action and cut, you get to, it's like someone going, you know all that shit you were told to do? Like, all the shit that you were told wasn't right about who you are. Empty it out there. Empty it all out. Like let it all fly about and fucking fuck shit up. That's heaven. That's absolute heaven. It's dangerous as well because it can be more vital than life sometimes, weirdly. I did a play, Death of a Salesman. I did this Arthur Miller play in New York. And me and Philip Seymour Hoffman played Willie. One of my favorite actors of all time.
Mine too.
Yeah. And I feel like we knew each other better on stage than we did off.
Really?
Yeah, because I don't think we could have gone as deep as those characters go.
Even though you're not saying your own words.
Oh, no, yeah, but it's universal. It's like we're speaking poetry to each other every night.
Right.
And we're talking to the deepest parts of each other from the deepest parts of ourselves every night. We had to be father and son. We had to share the same wounds and share the same longings, and we had to fall in love We had to be in love every night. It's like listening to a brilliant musician. You get revealed to yourself when you witness a piece of art that's inspired by something divine, you know?
When you're on stage doing that, having those moments, can you step outside yourself and notice it's happening at the time, or do you only
try not to? You try not to, but sometimes you go, fuck.
Yeah.
And it's like a defense mechanism, I think, because it's too hot. Because things get too hot for the ego or for the scared parts of yourself. But the idea is just you stay in it, but that takes real discipline and tricks. You have to kind of trick yourself back into not congratulating yourself, really.
Right.
Because you find that it's an inevitability. You know, in an ideal world, you're a shaman going into like a trance state. You want to go in, like, right? You
kind total of, like, present.
Everything else fades away. It's like when you fall in love, you know?
Yeah.
Like when you fall in love with someone and everything around them is just a blur and all you see is...
It's funny, like, thinking of coming to the theater every day and knowing you have to get there. It sounds tiring.
It's horrible.
Yeah.
It's horrible.
But that's what has to happen.
It's beautiful. It's just, like, painfully gorgeous, especially doing a play. Because you're being given a mountain every night. You're being given like a holy mountain to climb every night, and it's impossible. You never, and that's the beauty of it. You never
talk about the perfect melody, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Phil keeps coming up for me right now. So just kind of need to honor that he was someone that was just an artist and had no interest in the other shit. He would say, I wouldn't wish winning an Academy Award on my worst enemy.
Really?
Yeah, you know, his attention was on the thing that it was meant to be on all the time. It was always on the work. It was always on deepening the work. Just his integrity as a performer and as a director, theater director and film director. And just, you know, just true to himself. And also holding it lightly, you know. He was able to hold it lightly and kind of... flow with it, but also had this deep longing that was unquenchable.
Were you intimidated?
I was so
first
excited.
Day before.
No, I was so excited because I just finished. I was in the middle of shooting the first Spider-Man film, which was obviously its own beast, and I got the call from Scott Rudin, who was producing the play, and I immediately just said yes. Miller, Mike, Nichols, and Phil, and
do you
Scott.
Audition for something like that? Or
no, they asked me to do it. They asked me to play Biff, and I just said yes immediately. There was no hesitation. I was like, tell me when, I'll do it.
Yeah.
So I was. I mean, I wasn't intimidated actually, because there's something about Miller as well, where that feels just part of my ancestry in a weird way. Even, you know, I think having an American father and an American grandfather, you know, who would have been around, who would have been probably the same generation of Miller, there's some American dream deferred that lives in my bones that I understand that I've inherited from men of that generation, American
right.
men of that generation. It was like a ritual every night doing that play. It was like a really cool ritual that I got to do for my father and my grandfather, and my dad was there on opening night, and it was the most insane moment of art, life, healing, connection, total conscious understanding of why I do what I do, and it was a beautiful moment at the curtain call. It was a very potent evening. It was like, and I kind of came out for the curtain call, and I knew he was in the audience, obviously.
Right.
And I knew that there was a lot. It was father and sons. It was fathers and sons, you know. The play's about fathers and sons.
Yeah.
And I knew that he would be destroyed by the whole fucking thing.
Is that true?
Well, the curtain comes up for the end of the curtain call, and I'm still, you know, the end of the play is Willie's funeral, so it's shaky. You're shaky at the end of that play. You can't help it. It just works on you. And I look up. And the first person to stand up, the silhouette 20 rows back, is my father's bald head with his big ears. And he's directly in front of me 20 rows back. And it's like the silhouette, perfectly silhouetted, like in front of like a spotlight. And we just kind of looked at each other throughout the curtain call crying. I didn't know he was crying, but I knew he was crying. I couldn't see that he was crying, but I knew that he was just, and I was just like, oh shit, no, this is terrible. But it was so, so beautiful. And we didn't even need to talk about it. We just kind of like hugged for about 10 minutes afterwards. And we talked about it a lot since, but that night we just kind of let it be there. Yeah, it's really good. I mean, like that those are the moments where you go, oh God, this life can be really magical. Like life can be really magical if you stay in the fire and if you kind of go towards the thing that calls to you. It's really interesting when those kind of mysterious things happen.
Well, God, it brings up so many things. The theme of Death of a Salesman, it is the idea of people reconciling themselves with who they actually are versus their dreams. And yet, you are somebody who managed to go after an extremely low, statistically speaking, low success quotient dream and make it work. Were you a kid that knew from a young age that you were going to do something that consumed you, or were you looking for that thing, or were your parents pressuring you to have?
Yeah, there was a lot of
thing?
Pressure. There was a lot.
There
of,
was.
You know, me and my dad, we joke about it now. You know, he was he had a very specific set of needs for me and my bro. And I think it's thematically for me, it always comes back to kind of what we've been talking about already, but creating opportunity and safe space for other people to explore themselves as creative people, as because I had to really fight for that in my childhood.
You did?
Yeah, because...
How so?
Well, I came out of the womb just like a lunatic. I was just a monkey. I was just a fucking idiot. A clown, really. I was a clown. Like stupid. Like a wild animal.
Really?
Yeah. I got civilized.
Thank God for the room. I mean, with all the things you could do.
yes. The threat is still there, by the way. I haven't forgot it. And you too. No. I'm going to behave myself. There was, you know, you have to assimilate. And so as a young person, This wasn't an option. This it wasn't even in my consciousness. You know, I was, you know, it was like lawyer, doctor, business person.
Your brother's a doctor.
My brother's a doctor, yeah. So he kind of, you know, he did it so I didn't have to.
So your parents...
But the pressure was still there for me. Well, not my mother. My mother was more... my dad won't mind me talking about this. We've had such amazing conversations about this because he wanted to be a writer. He wanted to be a screenwriter.
Really?
Yeah, in LA because he was born here, and then he moved back. He moved to London and he moved back with my mum, and his fantasy was he would drive past the studios, and kind of like look through the gates and wonder what was going
now
on.
Now I'm understanding the Willy Loman connection that.
You know, he that was his dream was to be a writer. And because he's so creative and so brilliant and so funny, and but he sacrificed it. He sacrificed it to be provider, you know.
Yeah.
To be man, to be, you know, these concepts, which I'm grateful for because here I am, you know. And you know, he was very scared at first when I started to show it, when I let everything go when I was a teenager. I was just
what
like,
do you mean?
Fuck it. I couldn't do it. I was, you know, I couldn't assimilate.
Oh, so you were doing all the things that they wanted you to do.
I was supposed to, you know, I mean, in the sense of like, I loved doing sport and that kind of stuff. That was a really great outlet for me. I still love being physical. I need it. Otherwise I go insane. But, I just couldn't hang with the rules. I couldn't hang with the school system. I wasn't bad at school. I wasn't interested. And I tried to be. I tried. So I let everything go. I stopped doing sport. I got really depressed, actually. I got really, I lost. I felt I got totally lost in order to find the thing. I realize now it was intelligent design.
Wow.
You know, I had to let it all go I had to create space for the thing to show itself.
And how did that rub up against your dad's?
Oh yeah, it was rough, man. It was fucking rough between us because he was genuinely frightened, as a father would be, you know? Like, it's a rough world, and it's dog eat dog, and, you know, these are the things that the world values right now, so be one of those things and be safe and, you know, take care of it. It's like, you know, it's like good.
It comes from love.
Totally. No, yeah. It's like it was a beautiful impulse. Something in me was able to say, oh, sorry, I can't do it, though. I can't show up in the way that...
I think that's amazing, because there is a version of your life where you just turn the screw a little tighter on yourself and you're stuck with it, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like, business. Been business.
And did it come to a head ever with your dad?
Oh, yeah, it was a long time of coming to a head.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, yeah, really. Death of a Salesman was the moment where everything kind of... vanished, and it was just us.
You just had to make it to Broadway to assuage your dad's fears.
It wasn't even that. It was, I'd already done the Spider-Man thing, and he was already reassured that I wasn't going to die of like starvation as like an artist. But it was really that play where he went, oh yeah, and unlocked all. This is when we started talking about his dream to be a writer.
It unlocked, you didn't know.
I didn't know. No, he started to talk about it for the first time. It's like the buried manuscript in the cellar that has been collecting dust for 30 years, you know. Although, and then suddenly all these ideas start to blossom in him, and he's writing now. He's doing it for himself.
So
and,
you taught him. Well, in some ways, are you?
I don't know. I think we're the same. We're just the same person, actually. I think we're just the same person. And luckily enough, during this, while we're both alive, we're talking about it. You know,
yeah.
He could have done it with his dad, but they didn't have the opportunity. For whatever reason, me and him get to work it out together, which is really cool. So no, he made the sacrifices so that I could eventually be a fuck about. And be an actor and have the space to do that. And then because of those sacrifices, the ripples went into me having whatever success I've had. And because of that success, it opened up his being
wild?
To go, well maybe it's possible. Yeah, how beautiful.
That's beautiful.
Like, it's really cool, yeah.
I wonder if it set the stakes high for you.
Oh, yeah.
Because failure would mean that he was right and you were wrong.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It was like, this better fucking work out because... Yeah, no, it was... And that's why I think I like tension on set. Because I like a little bit of pressure.
Right.
Because he provided enough heat.
But did that create anxiety in you?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, I still struggle with it. I still that's the balance. It's all about balance for me.
Right.
It's like, I want that freedom... Where I can fail and fuck up and I don't have to get it right, and isn't this great that we can just fuck around? And like, this is nice, and I don't know, maybe this will work, maybe this will work. Maybe none of it will work, it doesn't matter. There's no money involved in this anyway. It's like, eat that light. I'm gonna eat that you know what I mean?
Right,
like,
right,
there's
right.
That part of me that needs expression, and then there's the other part of me which is also like, the kind of like the accountant that's like, looking over the whole thing, kind of like looking at the watch and kind of like, it's not good enough. Like that, there's something powerful and cool about that. Like the swimming coach cracking the whip on the side of the pool. There's I will say this, you know, it's my dad. It's totally his fault that I'm doing this, because you know he's a movie buff and he loves movies, and like that was our thing together. It was sports.
Really?
And it was like, you know, we would be athletic together, and he would make home movies. He was my first director. Like he would make these home movies. They were really not just for me and my brother to fuck around with, and it was really for him as well to play with the camera and to tell silly stories and like.
Gosh, it's so sad in a way that. He was this frustrated artist the whole time.
Yeah.
And yet he somehow bought into his own fear and passed it on to you that, like, you have to get serious.
But you also do have to get serious. Like, if I didn't have that, I wouldn't be talking to you right now. If I didn't have that, if I was just, like, this guy, it's like, you know... If I was just like,
do you think so? Do you, you think
I would,
that
I would be? A,
I think
I
it's like, the two sides.
Oh no, I would. There's nothing wrong with that. I would just be like, you know, I would be in a studio apartment in, I don't know. I would be doing like, you know, off, L.A. out, you know, in the Woods Theater with like an audience of five, which is not
maybe that'd
not,
be good actually.
There's that part of me that's like, that feels great. I want to do that. Like, who fucking get like money and success and status and blah blah blah? Fuck it. Who fucking needs it? That's the part of me that's like, I don't fucking care. I'll just be a monkey and just like throw everything around. But So yeah, you do have to have your feet planted in both worlds.
But you have to respect your talents too. And what I hear you saying is that you have to address going as far as you can go if you love it as much as you love it, right?
Like, yeah.
What do you love about acting?
It's a way to connect. It's a way to connect. It's like it's the story I told about me and my dad and Death of a Salesman. And it's a way to connect to lineage. In that moment, I felt like I was holding Arthur Miller's, I was literally holding Phil Hoffman's hand and Finn Wittrock's hand, played Happy. But I also felt I was holding my father's hand, I was holding my grandfather's hand, I was holding his father's hand, his father's father's father. I was holding the hands of generations of men who know this struggle. I was holding the hands, hopefully, of my future children and future generations that aren't going to inherit the sins of the father, that the buck stops maybe here, and that we're going to do some healing now so that you're not struggling. You'll have a whole different set of struggles by the time you come around. But maybe we can do some healing of this shit. And it's a connection. It's like the moment in that scene in The Social Network, connecting to that part of me that doesn't give a fuck what you think. Like, having the opportunity to get into that, like, to smash a laptop in front of a room full of tech guys.
And to just get
your balls out and say, and put them on the table and just go, there, that's who I am. Fuck you, you don't treat someone. How often do you get to do that in life? And you get
that's
to connect
right.
to aspects
without
of
going to jail.
Exactly, yeah. And you get to give voice to an impulse that's in everybody. That's like a heavy burden, and yet also just is an awesome responsibility. So it's a way of connecting.
Yeah.
And then hopefully if you do connect in that moment, that's why certain film moments become iconic, because it touches people in a way that wakes something up in themselves.
Yeah.
So it's all about connection for me, and being connected to myself, the story I'm telling, and therefore an audience that's receiving it. That's like, whoa. I love Q&As after films. I do. If it's a film that's powerful and that I actually really believe in, then there's no bullshit. Because the audience are just, they're talking about the film.
And you can speak from your heart.
Totally. And they're speaking from their hearts, because hopefully their hearts have been cracked open by the story they just saw.
Well, this is the thing I think that's insanely ironic about your profession, and that is that when you do your job well enough, you disappear into a character so completely that other people relate to that,
it becomes them, soul, yeah,
and they see themselves.
Totally.
But then they somehow mistake you, the person, for that, and this culture mm-hmm. of fame is created.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's almost like the byproduct of your success in some ways makes it harder for you to do your job, right?
Yeah. I would love more consciousness about what the job of the storyteller is.
What do you mean?
The storyteller being the actor, the director, the blah, blah, blah.
Right.
Especially in film. I think in theater, there's more opportunity. It's simpler. In theater, if someone sees me in a play, they know the difference between me and the character, and they know that I'm merely getting coffee and will be taking a shit at some point during the day.
Right.
And the conversation will be about the play. The conversation will be about the character. We will have a dialogue about who we are in relationship to the play and where we are in that story as individuals. And it's like sitting around a campfire kind of checking in with each other. Don't get that same experience when it's a film or a TV show, I think. I don't know why. I do know why. So many reasons. First of all, there's a screen. So there's that kind of separation between audience and that reality. And celebrity culture, which is propagated on a moment-to-moment basis. Even this kind of propagates it in a way. Like me feeling like I'm, like, you know, it's that there's a self-important thing that this could be. I don't believe this is what this is. This feels very, very different to anything that I've ever done press-wise. This feels like a genuine conversation.
Hopefully this isn't press at all.
No, it doesn't feel like press. It feels like a wonderful conversation about these things that we get to talk about art and about life and about
right.
the culture as it is. And it feels very personal, and it's lovely. So I would love more consciousness around the role of the storyteller in society, because it's been enmeshed with the role of God.
Well, there's a royalty aspect to it as well.
Yeah, which I'm
a removal.
Separation and an exaltation, a false worship of. And that's to do with, you know, actors on billboards, you know,
sure.
you know,
But it's very clear that you want to lead the life of a craftsman and a storyteller and an artist, whereas there may be a lot of people that get in your position that want to lead that exalted royalty life.
Well, who doesn't? There's a part of me that does. There's a part of me that loves, we all have an ego. Like, my ego is like, give it all to me. Give me everything. I want to eat it all, you know.
That light.
Specifically that light. Fuck you, I'm gonna fuck you, I'm gonna fuck it. Turn into Caligula. No, but you know what I mean? That's a part. We all want to be a god. There's a part of us that wants that kind of exaltation.
But it's the opposite of connection, isn't it?
It is. It's total disconnect. And it's a culture of disconnect as in the mainstream. And then when things do actually truly connect, something happens, and it's just like beautiful. But what I see mostly is the other thing, which is this disconnect, and which is the exaltation of the storyteller. But the storyteller, kind of like the fool, really needs to be the most human of all of us.
Right, and the story should be on the pedestal.
Exactly.
I see what you're
saying. That's the god in the room is the story. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Now I was thinking about what you just said about connection. I heard something you said about 99 Homes. Mm. And what you play to, you live with your mom and you get foreclosed on, and mm-hmm. your house gets repossessed, and mm-hmm. then you end up going and working for the guy who's repossessing homes. You sort of make a deal with the devil,
sure.
basically.
Yep.
And I read something where you said that when you were doing this, filming the scenes where you were going around and repossessing homes, mm-hmm. you didn't want to know who the actors were on the other side of the door.
Yeah, or if they were actors at all.
Or if they were actors at all.
I didn't know if anyone was going to be there or not. I just wanted to knock, yeah.
To me, that says something about your process.
Yeah. Hmm.
Tell me, like, what you're searching for in those kind of moments.
You know, Ken Loach is one of my favorite filmmakers, and the way he works has always fascinated me. Since working with Peter Mullen on Boyer, who did My Name is Joe, which is a great Ken Loach film, Peter would tell me about how Ken Loach worked, which is you don't get a script, every day you get pages, and then you'll be surprised every day by what happens. And you don't know where the camera is, you don't know where the boom operator is. Like, the boom operator is like disguised as a bush, and the camera is on a very, very long lens, like meters away, and it's...
And so the crew sort of knows that.
Crew knows.
The gig.
Crew knows, but the actors are given very, very little. Sometimes they're like, just show up here and you're going to go to a football match all together, and then something will happen.
That's exciting.
It's so exciting, and for me, it's like I just it just helps me. I just want all the help I can get. It's like that kind of Cassavetes feeling where everything feels like it's happening in the moment, because it's such an exciting way to work for me. And yet, I'm also intrigued by craft. Mel taught me a lot about being technical, like doing things that look good in camera, which I've never really thought about before.
What do you mean?
Like, especially with action stuff, kind of like you're running on a battlefield and you're kind of going over these undulating hills, and it's on like a very kind of tight shot here, kind of like if you just do it for real, your head's going to be in and out of the frame and the audience isn't going to know who the fuck it is and blah blah blah. So he was like, okay, so as you undulate, you have to, as you run over these hills, you have to like straighten up, be further up
for the dips,
and then you have to like run a bit lower on the top. And I'm like, how the fuck do you do that? Man, there's no way. He's like, I'll fucking show you how to do it. And he literally was just like, it looks so stupid. Until he played it back to me in camera, I was like, you look like epic. you look like a human, like a torpedo. So that stuff interests me too.
Right.
I find that trickier. I get a little...
The craft stuff.
I get a little bit frustrated with it. You know, it's that kind of like accountant. It's the accountant part of me that's like... I'm like, ugh, fuck off. I just want to like... But yeah, I loved working in that way on 99 Homes and... I would love to work like that again. You know, obviously, you know, the great thing about Marty as well is he's very precise in how he frames things, but he's so up for being surprised of what the actors are going to do.
Obviously, you want to respect and start right there with exactly how he sees it, but
sure.
Did you get to the point with him where you're able to say, hey, I kind of want to do something different, but like, were you able to?
Yeah, we did. You know what was wild and awesome was that from the beginning, I would, you know, I think I was a bit worshipy at the beginning, and I think he, you know, he's used to that, and that faded pretty quickly. But he would always just go, "It's right here. You got it right here. This is why I hired you. You know this maybe better than this guy meant it better than I do. You have to know him better than I do, and I think you do. So just trust that it's there." So he wanted to be surprised. He wanted to be taken on a ride every day.
Right.
And then in terms of like, you know, those looming scenes, and you go, "Oh fuck, these are great opportunities, and I want to make sure that you get the rawness that you need." And I was able to say on these days with him and Rodrigo, who shot it, I said, can we start, if there's a way of starting with my key shot, I'm just like, what do you think this is going to play on in your mind in the edit? So start with that, so that the performance in that series of takes is at its most raw and precise and spontaneous, and then we have that in the can, and then we can find moments around that in other stuff.
It's so revealing to your own, I mean, to exactly what you say, where you like the tension and the challenge.
Mm-hmm. No, I like showing up like I'm like a racehorse, like in those scenes, yeah, because I prep and then it's just like I build up so much energy that if it'll just be wasted if we don't capture it. And but he got it. He really respected that. And I think who worked? I think Keitel. He said that Keitel kind of works that way as well, where he'll in the first takes he'll just go wild and throw it all away and like fuck around and like play with things and say fuck it and fail. And but I think De Niro ramps up. I believe he shows up with nothing, and then just kind of lets it. I don't know. I'm talking in generalizations, really.
But it proves that there's no right way
there's
to
no
do
right
it.
Way.
There's just the way that works on the day and the moment.
Yeah.
Or the way that doesn't work that leads you to the way that works.
Yeah, right, exactly, yeah. And it's always changing as well. I think I'm becoming much more interested in showing up empty and seeing what
really?
Comes of that. Yeah, I'm becoming much more interested in that.
Showing not up. Doing a year of prep.
Yeah, exactly. Well, no, not so much that. It's more on the day of shoot, I mean.
Okay.
So, like, showing up for the scene, having done all the prep, and then literally just going, I don't know.
I wonder how that jives with the guy who needs to have a little fear.
Yeah.
Like, are you not working hard enough? Like, is the voice
right.
Like...
Right, yeah, exactly. That's always there. I never feel like I've done enough, prep-wise. I never feel... And that's what gets in the way of if that head comes into action and cut, then I'm in trouble.
Yeah.
I have to leave. I have to check that guy at the door. Then he gets to rule the roost until I'm walking to set, and then as soon as I'm on set, it's like you're not in charge anymore. Now it's playtime. You have to trust you've done enough now. And on Silence, it was a year. I had a year.
You had a year of prep.
Yeah.
So can someone like you go a little nuts with something like that?
I don't know about nuts, but the prep, I say a year of prep, but it was a year of life. It was a year of like exploration. I became like a theology student, really. Like that's what, because they're playing a Jesuit priest. So I went beyond prep for the film. It was really, everything was connected. It was, the film was connected. I was connected to myself in a different way, to the world in a different way, to religion in a different way, to spirituality, and it was all being fused into Marty's project, and it was just heaven. Everything was just firing off. And I can say that now. At the time, it felt... I wasn't aware of how special... I was aware that it was a special time, but right now, I'm looking back and going, oh, that was really blessed.
Well, listen, I want to... finish with one thing, but
I feel like we talked about a lot.
I feel like we just started. I could talk to you forever.
It's
but
cool,
I did want
yeah.
to ask you something about Boy A.
Okay.
What struck me most in rewatching it was thinking about how still inexperienced you were at that point.
Yeah.
I read that you watched the film 7 or 8 times by yourself trying to prepare for an audience seeing it. And I got the sense that you had no idea if you'd given a good performance or a bad performance.
Yeah, the struggle remains. It's still there. It's still there.
Do you have those moments after every film of...
Never. I never know.
I never know.
It's this perpetual dissatisfaction. It's this... I can watch a film and see whether it's truthful, what I'm doing. But it's this weird blind spot I have. I have a blind spot about... self-worth, I suppose, in the work. I really have, I can oscillate between total grandiosity and total insecurity and complete middle way where I go, it is what it is, and I did my best, and it's not untruthful, and let's leave it to people to have their experience. I'm all over the map with it. It's so weird. It's like a weird, like I'm cursed. Like I can't, like, you know, I know like some people can just love everything they do and like watch themselves with such joy in their hearts, and I envy that. And other people just think they're terrible all the time, which is not enviable. But I can go all over the fucking place with it. It's totally bizarre, and it has
the same thing, the same performance, and you can feel one way about it one day and one way about it the other.
Yeah, yeah, totally, absolutely. The same moment where I go and like I'll watch something and I'll be like, oh, and like, oh, I love that. That moment worked great. So the next time I'm sat in front of it, I'm like, oh, thank God that moment's coming up. I'll be able to enjoy that moment because that was good. It's like, oh, it's terrible.
Really?
Yeah, it's totally bizarre.
So when you were watching that film before the world had seen before, yeah. You know, was there some scenario where it's like, well, this is the only chance I'll get to act?
Every time I feel that way.
Do you really?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
God.
Totally. No, it's torture. But what choice do I have? I can't do anything else. I don't want to do anything else. Like, I really want to do this, so I have to just do it. It's just this tough thing where I have to keep showing up. I remember the first time I was about to walk on stage for the first time, because I did plays in England before I did any films or TV. And I thought I was going to die.
Really?
Yeah, I literally thought my body was going to, burst into
flames.
What did
that feel like? Did it feel like you were sick?
No, it was just like, it was just so much heat. It was just too much heat. I thought I was going to burst into flames. Like, I was about to do a thing at the Globe Theatre in London as my first public performance.
Well, that's...
Yeah, it's a big deal.
That's a big deal.
It's a big deal, but it could have been anywhere.
People have burst into flame before.
Sure, but I could have been anywhere. I would have had the same feeling. And I remember walking up and down the south bank of the River Thames in London. And the reality sinking in, and it comes back to my dad. My dad was going to be in the audience, and he just like helped me to go to drama school, and he wanted was going to see if his investment paid off, and all this stuff. Not only that, but like everyone, all my friends were going to be there, all drama schools from around the country, and like, I literally thought I was going to die. I literally was like, if I walk onto that stage, I'm going to die. I cannot do it. There is no way I can do it. I'm a fraud. I have nothing to offer. That was the first feeling I had.
Wow.
Totally weird. Totally fucking crazy. But the reality was, you know, thankfully, it was actually a moment. There was a song that got me on stage. It was I was walking up into the South Bank, and there was a busker playing a song that an ex-girlfriend had given to me that I hadn't really paid much attention to before. And I never listened to the lyrics properly. It was a pretty song. And I,
oh, you mean this was a guy
on the South Bank who was just a guy.
Just happened to be there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
And he was playing this song, and it was Vincent by Don McLean about Van Gogh. Sorry, Starry Night. It was something happened. Something happened, and I don't want to call it. It's mysterious. But it was like everything shifted inside me, and I realized that I actually had, if I didn't do it, I would die. If I didn't go on stage, I would die. That was what actually was happening, that this was actually saving my life. There was some, I just got struck by the lyrics of that song, and I think there was some conscious understanding of what it was to attempt to make art and be an artist.
God, I hope you tipped him.
Oh yeah, no, I just like, I stood in front of him, like cried my eyes out. Literally the clouds parted, like sun came out. He wasn't even a very good singer or a very good guitar player, but he had gotten up that morning. He had gotten out of bed. He had picked up his instrument. He had walked onto his stage on the concrete by the South Bank, and he had breathed in. And he had let himself express himself in the way that he felt called to. And because he did that, because he showed up simply, just showed up with all of his fallibility, with all of his shit, with all of his not enoughness, with all of his imperfection, I was like, okay, I get it, I hear you, I've got to show up. No matter if I'm as bad as this guy, I've got to fucking show up, because some kid out there might go, well, if this motherfucker can do it, then I'm working. Maybe I am. So it's ripples and kind of like, oh, fuck. All right, I get it. I have to go. And of course it's a song by an artist talking about an artist, being sung by an aspiring artist, being received by someone who's just understanding what being an artist might mean. So it's suddenly like, oh shit, okay, I get it. And then, thank God, you know, literally, or you know, God. I don't know if God's the right word. You know, I'll use that word for now. But yeah, it's interesting.
Hearing that story, the idea of living a life as an artist or putting yourself out there as an artist, it's such a tenuous idea that can be knocked down
totally
by a day of bad feeling about yourself. It's gone, right? It's
fucking like
a little sandcastle or something.
You're a piece of shit.
And it's gone.
Like one bad review. Or like a bad, like a, and a, within a good review, a piece of criticism, and you're just like, you're fucking nothing. It's like, oh my God, so fragile.
It's amazing anyone makes it
to
the place.
You have to have a thick skin while also being so vulnerable simultaneously.
Yeah.
And because as soon as you guard up your vulnerability, there's no point in showing up as far as I'm concerned. But it is a cool story, and I'm glad I have that story under my belt to go back to. I'd be in the wings on Death of a Salesman, kind of like having a bad night, and wanting to run, that same feeling of like, oh, I want to run away. I don't want to go. It was so nice to be able to play that song in my head and go, all right, fucking step. It doesn't go away. It hasn't gone away yet. I don't think it will go away. I think I'm always going to be having to listen to that song.
And also, it doesn't seem like you're an artist that's going to coast. So you're going to keep finding ways where it's a little more difficult the next time, or a little more. There's some new challenge each time, and that's.
I think so. Yeah, I think it has to be. I wish I could coast. It would be nice. But the accountant's up there going, we've got to keep growing.
I don't think it's the accountant. I think it's. Yeah. I think it's the whatever the muse or the artist inside of it. I think the accountant's thinking like, we're good.
No, the accountant is never enough.
No.
The accountant's like, this is never going to be enough. It's never going to be enough, motherfucker.
You know, it's funny. Maybe the entire world's entertainment is based upon the fact that there's poor souls on the earth that never feel enough. And we're all entertained.
Oh, but what a beautiful longing. The longing of the clown to like, am I okay? Do you like me? Is it all right? Like, that's a beautiful longing. Like, to turn that deep, wounded longing into, you know, that's where the juice is. That's where the gift is flowing from in a weird way. It's coming from the wound.
Well, listen, I loved talking to you about
this. Me too,
man. And I could keep going. But thank you for being so honest and sharing.
No, man, thank you. Thanks for creating. You know what? You created the space for it. So these spaces are rare, I think, in our culture right now, so thank you for creating the space for this kind of depth.
Not a lot of white
conversation. Not a lot of white padded cells.
No, that's right.
It's great. So
thanks,
thank you.
Man.
No, thanks, Sam. Really, truly.
Hey folks, that's our show for today. Thanks for listening. And if you haven't done it in a while, go to offcamera.com and check out the store. We have magazines in both subscription form and in single issues with exclusive photographs, extra content, and it's just a really cool way to spruce up your coffee table and show your support for Off Camera. So check that out at offcamera.com. And be sure to join me next week when I sit down with actress, writer, and director Greta Gerwig.
One thing I know from acting and also from writing that I kind of tried to use as much as I could in directing was like, lean into your peculiarities. They are what make you you. Even if it's weird or it feels wrong, like you gotta go with the thing that you feel good about because you're the only one who's ever gonna make it.
The New York Times says she may well be the definitive screen actress of her generation. What's funny about that is that she's so natural and transparent, it's very hard to catch her acting. She's also an extremely talented writer and director. If there's one thing I love, it's someone who can't pick a lane and stay in it. See you next time, off camera.